From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we have two segments about the power of social media. First, how the TikTok app helped boost the biggest songs of the summer. Then the documentary Jawline follows a fledgling social media influencer and the teenage girls who pay money to meet him.
And the emotions that were at that show were just insane to me. People freaking out, going crazy, crying, feeling like they had met the love of their life, but it was thousands of girls per one boy.
And Peter Dinklage on playing Hervé Villechaize in the Emmy-nominated My Dinner with Hervé. All that coming up on The Frame. TikTok is a very popular app with millions of teens and young adults, but even if you've never used or heard of TikTok, you've likely seen its short videos on Instagram or Twitter. TikTok's content ranges widely, but there's no question the app plays a huge role in turning songs into hits, and that means money for the music industry. Brittany Spanos wrote in Rolling Stone about her week of exploring TikTok, and she explains how the app is designed to make videos go viral.
They're usually edited in a really fast pace. And the basis of the videos for most of them is that you tend to add a song from a well of songs that are available. And also not just songs, but any variety of audio that people can upload to the app on their own. They can lip sync to it. They can do various challenges to that audio. Songs are really popular for a lot of the TikTokers out there.
And I would say that the variety of production is profound. There's an amazing video with a goldfish on a counter surrounded by lots of edible goldfish. I think the user said she spent 8 hours making that video. It's to an Adele song. And then there are a lot of things of people just kind of goofing off. So is that typical as well, that you get people who really spend a lot of time producing these videos and other people who just record themselves in a bathroom?
First off, that goldfish video is my favorite TikTok that I've seen. But yeah, I mean, the variety is pretty overwhelming. I think that what's interesting in contrast to Vine, which the users were doing a lot of the same challenges typically, but TikTok is all over the place. I mean, there are people who use it to kind of monologue. There are people who do dance challenges. There are people who are singing on there, people who are doing these really orchestrated videos and scenes that they're making. There's a variety in ages of the users. It's really fascinating how many different genres and styles of videos have come about in really a year.
The other thing that's interesting about the goldfish video is the Adele song, Someone Like You. It's a live version. So it does feel like people are looking at different ways of presenting music. And that gets us to a different conversation, which is about the songs that were really the chart toppers of the summer. One was Lil Nas X's Old Town Road. And the other one is Billie Eilish's Bad Guy, which is now the number one hit. So how much of those songs' success can be attributed to TikTok?
Yeah, I think it's sort of an interesting double-edged sword for it, because both those songs are as responsible for TikTok being put on the map more so, as well as those videos helping those songs grow, which is really fascinating to look at. But I mean, in terms of TikTok itself, because when it first became a big app, it was coming from these Gen Z, really young, creative lip syncers who were making just like really funny, quick viral videos that were starting to spread beyond TikTok, which is another point to make, is that TikTok makes it super easy to share on other social media platforms. You can share those videos directly from the app to your Instagram story, to Twitter, to literally anything you want to upload it to. But Old Town Road by Lil Nas X was one of the earliest songs to really blow up on the app and became a meme challenge. I got the horses in the bag. I mean, meme challenges beyond TikTok have been such an important way for songs to become famous. If we remember the mannequin challenge with Black Beatles, for Old Town Road to be part of a general newfound love for yeehaw culture and country culture and turned into a kind of like fashion dance challenge hybrid that it became. I mean, that in itself, because it was spreading so quickly beyond TikTok, really helped both the song and the app blow up. And same with Bad Guy. I mean, it was both those songs are positioned at a really fascinating time in their own growth with how the app was even reaching more and more people.
We're talking with Brittany Spanos at Rolling Stone about TikTok. Let's play a little bit of Billie Eilish's song, Bad Guy.
I'm the bad guy. Duh.
Are there certain songs that work well on TikTok and that maybe lend themselves to challenges where people are trying to outdo one another in terms of how they've incorporated a clip from a song into some sort of short video?
The pace of a song like Bad Guy really helps the very choppy editing of a lot of TikTok videos and kind of matches that very well and is really quick and it's really fresh and it's recognizable. So it's really about just sort of lobbing onto a very specific sound and pace of a song, as well as very literal lyrics being translated. For example, Boys by Lizzo had created a meme where people were taking all the list of boys that she mentions and cut between different dogs or like different stuffed animals or different people. And it's really fascinating how that in particular has been what stuck.
I'm wondering, are music labels starting to embrace TikTok? How would you describe the relationship between the artists and the labels and these videos?
I mean, a lot of labels have worked with TikTok users in particular. We're seeing a lot of TikTok influencers, if you will. And there have been cases where A&R people, managers, will pay TikTok users to play their song. I mean, that was a big part of Old Town Road, was that a user had been paid money to make a video with Old Town Road very early on. And then from that, it just spread. It's not super new for them to kind of glom onto a lot of these challenges. Labels were trying to create these not very organic challenges around songs. So, I mean, with TikTok, it's much easier to make it seem like an organic thing and seem like a very natural sort of way that people are finding this music.
And it also seems like there's a different kind of meritocracy in terms of who gets noticed. There is a woman who does cookie decorating TikToks. There's a dentist who does TikToks about making braces. Does it feel that it maybe, I don't know if democratic is the right word, but the barriers to entry or stardom are lower?
Yeah, I mean, on my For You page the other day, I saw a priest who's now TikTok famous. Like, it's really anyone. That's really the most fascinating part about it for me, is that this didn't really exist with any other apps. It's very easy to make videos through it. That makes it appealing to people who didn't really understand what to do with Vine or to do with, you know, any other app before it.
Brittany Spanos is a staff writer at Rolling Stone. She's the author of the article, "I Spent a Week on TikTok and All I Got Was a New Phone Addiction." Brittany, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up next on The Frame, the power and peril of being a young social media influencer. If you haven't heard of the live streaming app called YouNow, this next interview might make you feel a little bit old. The app plays a central role in a new Hulu documentary called Jawline. It's a film about the world of pretty boy influencers, their fangirls, and the emerging culture of live streaming celebrities. Filmmaker Liza Mandeloup embedded herself in this curious corner of the social media world for a year before she found a 16-year-old boy named Austin Tester. He's a charismatic live streamer whose only obvious talent is, well, let's just say it has to do with the film's title. Here's Liza Mandeloup on the genesis of Jawline.
It kind of started with me thinking I wanted to tell a story about teenagers in love and what it looks like today. What does that feeling look like for a teenager when technology is like an extension of yourself? So I just started thinking about those themes and doing some research, and I found these things called meet and greets, which are in the film, where these teenage girls were paying money to spend time with the boy that they had been following online. Hug them, take a photo with them, kiss them, and the emotions that were at that show.
When I met him, I was like, oh my gosh, I love you. And he was like, oh, I love you too. And I was like, oh, yay.
When we went to a couple of them early on in the process, were just insane to me. Like, people freaking out, going crazy, crying, feeling like they had met the love of their life, but it was thousands of girls per one boy.
It's kind of like, I think for older people, it's like young girls when the Beatles came to the country.
Yeah.
And yet these kids don't do anything. It's not like they're singing. I mean, they're like just there. Some of them shoot silly string at people. Some of them kind of lip sync or dance around. But they don't have any real performance, do they?
Well, I mean, the concept is the live streaming world is about live with me, live my life with me, and I will be affectionate to you on social media. I'll be positive towards you. I'll tell you, you look great. I'll ask you how your day was, but I'm just a regular person, which is really bizarre to me. Like, it's like their commodity is just sort of this validation to these girls. The ridiculous part of the film is what that in-person experience is. Like, what are you paying for? You're basically paying just to see the person you've been following on a screen in person for the first time.
And their emotions are totally real. I mean, they are sobbing. They are so moved. They're not faking it.
No, they're not. They're not. And it's a really intense moment for them. We captured a lot of that in the film. But, you know, we filmed over like a couple of years, and sometimes I'd meet a girl and then, you know, 6 months later, a year later, she's like, I don't do that anymore. I can't even believe I was into that. I've moved on. It's just like a moment in their life. And I think that really relates to the internet in general. Everything is just a moment.
One of the people you spend a lot of time with is a kid named Austin Tester. He's a 16-year-old who is in a small town in Tennessee named Kingsport. And he is a very interesting and complicated kid. But I want to ask you how you found him and how you thought and why you thought he was a good person to spend time with.
I mean, I filmed in this world for about a year before I even met him. I was going to a lot of shows. I was reaching out to a lot of managers. It was very hard to actually get access to a lot of the boys. I had originally made a short film called Fangirl, and it followed three girls who were all madly in love with the same boy that they were going to meet at one of these meet and greets.
He means like the world to me. Like I feel like I've been like his best friend for like all these years, but I've only met him one time.
Through that film, I kind of became obsessed with figuring out who these boys were. Like, I was spending so much time with these fangirls that I sort of developed the same obsession of being like, who are these guys? Like, I want to know them too. And I was following them. But it was actually quite difficult to get access to them because I was going through the same channels that a lot of these fangirls go through. So I realized that I needed to contact managers and try to figure out how to get on some of these tours through a manager. But I knew I needed to find a main character that I was rooting for, that I really liked, that had the high stakes, that had something more than just wanting fame. And one thing led to another, and someone had randomly found Austin online, and we had the chance to meet him. And it was like instantly when me and my crew met him, we were like, this is our lead. We just adored him.
Fame to me is really important. When you become famous, you have a lot of people that look up to you.
He is a very positive kid, and he comes from a very troubled family, abusive father, single mom. They're not well off. But his message is all about inspiring other people to follow their dreams.
My dream is not to get famous, and then that's just it. My goal is to get famous, the money comes, and then I start helping the world.
And I think he really has this hope that he can somehow use what he's doing online to create a new life for himself and somehow get out of this small town. Is that what you started to sense from being with him?
Austin's a dreamer, and I think that I'm always attracted to characters like that. He came from a situation where not many people in his town are able to have these big life dreams. Like, they don't see that as an option. Nobody tells them that's an option. And somehow Austin, against all odds, got that in his head that I want to get out of this place. I want to make a difference. But he didn't really have the support to do that when he decided he wanted to do that. And what gave him that support? The internet. And so Austin kind of represents this modern teen to me where you're no longer stuck in your circumstances. You can seek this other community online. And so what he did have was Wi-Fi. It wasn't even very good Wi-Fi, but he had Wi-Fi, you know?
We're talking with Liza Mandeloup. She's the director of a new documentary called Jawline. I think it's very easy to look at the girls who are so obsessed with a lot of these young boys and say it's kind of vacuous idolatry. But then the more time we spend with these girls, I think the more we start to understand what is in it for them. That often they are girls who are somehow marginalized. They might be unpopular. They might be gay or lesbian, and they're not recognized positively for who they are. Did you start to detect certain kinds of people, certain kinds of girls, even if they're all radically different.
Absolutely, yeah.
And what would you say their common attributes are?
I think that a lot of these girls were escaping something, and they were all looking for a way out of whatever their situation was, whether it was family problems, whether they were abandoned by the men in their life, whether they were being bullied at school, or they had, you know, learning disabilities, or a lot of girls talked about cutting themselves. Like, they just had a lot of struggle. And what they needed was to feel good about themselves. And, you know, for a teenage girl, it's actually really hard because you don't really connect with your parents very much at that age. And if people at school are being mean to you, and, you know, you're more mature than a lot of the boys in your school, so you're looking for some sort of intimacy.
Another element that you spend time with, and this is where I think the film, for me and a lot of people, is probably the most disturbing, are the managers, the people who are trying to promote these social media broadcasters and monetize them. There's a person you meet named Michael Wiest. We meet him early on in the documentary, and he's pretty honest about what is in it for him. Let's listen to what Michael Wiest has to say.
The nature of this social media business is making as much money as quick as you can, because everything has a expiration date and a time limit.
It's 20K now, so you have to do something.
Dude, screw you. Like,
do a handstand. Let's test that out.
My goal is to capture the ones that I think are better than the rest, take them, rebrand them, monopolize that, so that everyone who's not part of that vision is taken out of the industry, so that it keeps quality control up and more money in my pocket.
Tell us more about Michael. He is a fascinating character in for both better and worse.
Yeah, I keep thinking of him as like a young Steve Jobs. He's just like an opportunist. It's a weird world to be managing young teenage boys who are putting out content for these girls. And I think it takes someone who is young and also part of that generation to really understand even what it is. So he kind of, you know, was able to create this world where they all lived in a mansion together and they created content all the time. And they looked at him like he was their manager, but he was also their friend and their equal. And it was just a really interesting dynamic to me. And the whole film kind of has this, it's an ecosystem that's like teenagers feeding off other teenagers.
What have been the most surprising reactions from both older and younger viewers to what you made?
I mean, it's been amazing because when screening the film, there's a lot of laughs, and then people leave and they tell me they're like completely horrified. And I think that people were so into it because it was like discovering a new world. And we always knew that when we were making the film that we had to set up this world for someone who may never know anything about it. And then on the flip side, I talked to like a teenager who's in my screening, and she had never seen that side of it.
You never explain the title of your film?
Oh, yeah.
What does it mean to you? What does Jawline mean?
So Jawline is, represents a lot of what the entry point into this world is for these boys. They kind of think, okay, I want to become something on social media, on this live broadcasting app. What do I have to do to be someone that girls like? And the first thing is this Instagrammable, chiseled jawline. And then when we told a lot of the boys that we were naming it Jawline, they were like, oh, yeah, we get it. And all the girls in that world got it, too. And it just represents the market to me, really, is that it's like that's one of the only qualifiers to get in.
Liza Mandeloup is the director of the documentary Jawline. Liza, thanks so much for coming in and talking about your movie.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Coming up, Peter Dinklage on playing Hervé Villechaize in the Emmy-nominated movie My Dinner with Hervé. For more than 14 years, filmmaker Sasha Gervaisi and actor Peter Dinklage tried to get a film made about Hervé Villechaize. He's the French actor who played Tatou on the TV series Fantasy Island. My Dinner with Hervé finally debuted on HBO last fall, and now it has an Emmy nomination for Outstanding TV Movie. Today, we revisit my conversation with Gervaisi and Dinklage. Gervaisi interviewed Villechaize near the end of his life in 1993, and he recalls the time the actor pulled a knife on him.
I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I didn't really understand what was going on. And he said to me, I've told you all the bullshit stories. Now do you want to hear the real story of my life?
Of course, it was Dinklage who had to portray Villechaize.
I will never be Hervé. That's the trick of playing somebody who was a real person, especially with not much historical distance from them, because everybody knows, if they don't know Hervé's life, if they don't know who he is, they know what his voice sounded like in the Fantasy Island little thing where he says about the plane.
And I said that to Peter. I said, you know, at a certain point, every role you've played, or most of them, are different versions of yourself.
Yeah.
And this is the first time you're going to be playing someone who is a character, a real person, who's totally different. And that's really the interesting terrain, because Hervé and Peter are so completely different. There are such big contrasts, as well as
similarities. Yeah, but what also really attracted me to it was our similarities in terms of... there's a funny combination in both of us of sort of, for lack of a better word, anger and theatricality. I think we share...
As people or as performers?
Yeah, no, as human beings.
Okay.
Well, don't tell John the truth, Peter. This is a radio program. You know,
shut up, director.
I mean, what I love about that moment that Sasha talked about earlier with, it's terrible what he did. Nobody should pull a knife on anyone else. But there's a very complicated thing that happens in that moment where it's, because of his size, is it taken seriously? And is he being serious in that moment? Is he being really pissed off at Sasha, or is he being theatrical? Is he getting his attention? And I think it's a combination of everything, and that's what's so sort of beautifully complex about that moment, because Sasha's reaction is like, oh my God, this dwarf is pulling a knife on me. If it was like a big guy, it'd be terrifying. But and it was in the moment, as Sasha describes it, but it's also sort of amusing. So I sort of find that very complicated.
I want to play a scene from the movie where Hervé actually does bring a knife. This is where he is trying to get signed by a talent agent, and he comes into this office unannounced of talent agent Marty Rothstein.
My name is Hervé Villechaize. I am the best French actor of his generation. And I need the best agent of his generation to represent me. You are the best, no?
Can you put the knife down, please?
Tomorrow creeps in this petty place from day to day.
Hervé Villechaize doing Macbeth?
Let's
threatening an agent at knife
complicate
point.
It more by doing Shakespeare. Thank God I used to do that monologue in acting class.
Is that true?
Oh, my God.
It's great. But
what is it about that scene about Hervé's belief in himself and his determination to become an actor that he's willing to go to this very unusual length to try to get signed?
I had no idea what was going through Hervé's head. Oftentimes, when Sasha and I would talk about that. I just know from my vantage point that I think he was doing exactly what he was getting his attention. I mean, that's some balls right there. But I mean, I find that really, really fun.
I mean, I think that's really sums Hervé up. Is he had this? He was really ballsy. He had great courage. And remember, in the face,
if you weren't going to open the door to him, he would knock it down.
That's right. And there was something wonderful about that because of, if you see a little bit from the film, his upbringing, how complicated it was being a dwarf in a family of three boys, the other three of whom were normal size, quote unquote, going through all these treatments, walking down the street in Paris and being attacked. So when, you know, André, the father, you know, sent him to New York with a few $100s, it was like, you're in danger here. You need to go, quote unquote, where the freaks go. And that he was embraced. And so he had this kind of defiance and this courage and this relentless need to be taken seriously and also to be seen and celebrated as he was.
I want to ask you, Peter, about access to roles, because I think it's very important that Hervé Villechaize really became famous, more or less, for The Man with the Golden Gun, a James Bond film in which he was cast, in which his character was contingent on his size. That was the joke mm-hmm. of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you, in The Station Agent, Tom McCarthy's great film, your physical attributes had nothing to do with the part that you were playing.
Well, you can't pretend it's not part of who I am. I think that's maybe equally not such great writing as people just completely focusing on the fact that I am. That's when I pass on a script, when it's just every page you're reminded that this person is 4.5 feet tall. or if it sort of has nothing to do with the person, that's sort of, well, you're sort of avoiding the elephant in the room. There's a balance there. On that day when we were filming, we did a reenactment of Roger Moore stuffing Hervé Villechaize into an oversized suitcase, which is the end of A Man with the Golden Gun. It was a really bizarre day on set that day, being literally stuffed into an oversized suitcase, because I don't think I could ever do that. And that's not a judgment on Hervé's choice to say, okay, I will do that. It's just, it's really just not so nice.
No, it's not
nice. A little bit demeaning.
And
it's
also
not a little bit demeaning. I mean, yeah. It's completely
demeaning. But it's completely acceptable. And that still happens today with people my size. And people are in charge of their own lives. They're free to do what they want career-wise. And I don't lay in judgment of it. But that's just something I have to be happy with who I am at the end of the day. And in the eyes of my children.
Peter and Sasha, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Sean. Thank you, John.
And that's all for today. Remember, you can keep up with us through our weekly email. You could sign up at theframe.org/newsletter. I'm John Horn. We're back here tomorrow at the Moen Broadcast Center.